From KALW News in San Francisco, this is CrossCurrents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Berkeley.
Berkeley, California.
Yeah, I'm from Walnut Creek and also from Thailand.
El Cerrito.
From Oakland.
From Albany, California.
Coming up, we take a look at how body cameras and cell phone footage are changing policing.
I definitely think that the body-worn camera has sort of a civilizing effect on both ends of the camera.
Then an artist and cultural activist talks about why storytelling is so important.
For a lot of the immigrants, not being able to speak, as one of our storytellers said, he felt like when he walked out in the street, a zipper has been zipped across his mouth.
And we find out the answer to this week's audiograph mystery sound.
Doorbell, stable.
Hop aboard. CrossCurrents is next. The shooting death of Mario Woods, captured with cell phone footage, occurred just an hour before the San Francisco Police Commission passed a new body camera policy. The new policy prohibits officers from reviewing footage in critical situations, meaning officers can't watch the footage after incidents, so the videos won't change their reports. That's a small step towards eventually equipping the entire department with the body cameras. As they make their plans, San Francisco city officials can look to Oakland, one of the first major cities to use the cameras. But that doesn't mean the Oakland Police Department has all the answers either. Reporter Holly J. McDeed went to Oakland to see what the cameras do show and what they don't.
Oakland Tribune crime reporter David DeBold still remembers when he got the call from the Oakland Police Department. They wanted local reporters to come to police headquarters to watch body camera footage that showed two recent officer-involved shootings.
Sort of set a precedent there. There really hasn't been a department in the Bay Area that's released body camera footage. I mean, these devices are rather new.
Oakland police have had body cameras since 2010, but the agency still hasn't worked out a policy for what to show the public. So DeBolt gathered with about 10 other local reporters in the Oakland Police Department headquarters and...
They just played the video. If you can imagine holding a camera on your shoulder and running, it's a very choppy footage, you know, kind of bobs up and down. And these three officers were running. It was a foot chase.
The first video was of Nate Wilkes, who police say had a gun when they shot him. DeBolt says it's hard to see. Then, DeBolt says, they moved on to footage of Richard Lynyard. In the footage, he's on the run, he hops a fence, and then he's gone.
They stop the chase, and they start a search.
That sound from the first 35 seconds of the chase. Police released it last fall. There's no footage available for the 20 minutes that happened next. When the camera comes back on, it shows police performing CPR on Lynyard's lifeless body. Some, including Lynyard's mother, still believe he was murdered by police during the 20 missing minutes. But DeBolt says he couldn't determine that.
It's not my job to determine whether or not the shooting's justified or not. I just lay out the facts.
Oakland Police Chief Sean Wendt says he doesn't want to release footage that can jeopardize an investigation, but...
You know, I also have a competing desire to sort of prevent a riot from occurring. And if correcting the misinformation that's out there will help in that regard, then I think we have to consider that.
The Oakland Police Department is still trying to strike that balance.
I don't believe that we've worked this out entirely, and I also don't believe that across the state there's any kind of uniformity in this at all.
Wendt says the biggest impact of the cameras has been how officers and citizens react, just knowing they're being watched. The cameras, resting on the officers' shoulders, are neon green and they glow. And over the last 4 years, the department has seen a 70% reduction of use of force.
I wouldn't credit it all to the body-worn cameras, but I definitely think that the body-worn camera has sort of a civilizing effect on both ends of the camera. I think the officers behave better, know they're being recorded. But I think in many cases that the people they're dealing with also behave better.
But when something does go wrong, Oakland's body cameras don't always tell the whole story. Take, for example, the footage that was released earlier this year that showed the officer-involved death of Hernan Jaramillo outside his East Oakland home. Before we go on, just a warning that the audio from this video is disturbing.
You
You're going to stay here until you relax.
I can't breathe, sir. I can't breathe.
Jaramillo is on the sidewalk outside his house. Officers are holding him to the ground and telling him to calm down.
Relax. There's no reason to act like this. All we wanted to do was talk to you.
Okay.
Sir, do you see what you're doing? You're tensing up.
No one's pushing on your chest, sir.
I can't breathe.
In the video, you can hear him plead for his sister, Anna Biasini, to help, while officers reassure him he's not in danger. His nickname for her was Botina.
I lose my hair, Botina. They're killing me right now.
Then, for a while, after my body was completely and silent.
Biasini remembers that night. She says she heard loud sounds from her brother's room. So she called the cops, who mistook Jaramillo for an intruder. Officers say he resisted when they tried to detain him. But Biasini and her family say the cops should have called for medical help sooner.
The video is live. It tells exactly what happened. It's so, you know, shows you the truth about that night.
The footage wasn't released to the public until Biasini and her family settled a wrongful death lawsuit for $450,000. After her family in Colombia saw the footage, they decided to reverse the settlement. Now they think they've got a shot in court. To them, the proof is in her brother's screams for help. But that's also part of the trouble. The screams might be loud and clear, but the images, Biasini admits, are dark and blurry.
In the video, is you cannot see very, very much. Is you can see like shadows in the dark shadows and gray shadows.
They may not answer all the questions.
John Burris is Biasini's attorney. And he says the footage alone isn't enough to prove the officer's actions caused her brother's death. Here's why. The city claims Jaramillo died as a result of cocaine in his system.
City's view was, well, he was under the influence of drugs, and so he was intoxicated, and so he became excited, and as a consequence of that excitement, it's called excited utterance, he died.
The video footage doesn't rule this possibility out.
Our view is no. You prevented him from breathing, and by suppressing his diaphragm, and he was trying to breathe, and ultimately he lost oxygen to the brain, and therefore he died.
And, well, the video footage doesn't rule this possibility out either.
And videos do have different perspectives, because at the end of the day, you have to fill it in.
But, he says, without the footage, people would have to rely mostly on the police officer's version of events. Body cameras are like an extra witness.
The police have a tremendous media machine that is designed to project the police in the most positive light at all times, regardless of what they've done. And a video camera is one mechanism to undercut that.
Officer Albi Esparza works for what Burris calls the media machine. He's the San Francisco Police Department's public information officer, and he knows firsthand how body cameras and cell phone footage have changed policing, not just in San Francisco, but nationwide.
In the past, you know, people thought that there was a thin blue coat of blue of silence, and like that doesn't exist anymore.
The most recent shooting to come to light is the death of Mario Woods, who was shot by police in San Francisco's Bayview neighborhood last year. Since then, there's been widespread protests, plus three local investigations and an investigation from the Federal Justice Department. But recently, the San Francisco City Attorney ruled that the police who shot and killed Mario Woods acted lawfully to protect themselves and bystanders from a man who was armed with a knife. Esparza says he understands how that could make people angry, since the shooting activists have called for the resignation of Police Chief Greg Suhr.
No one wants to see anybody, you know, shot and killed, regardless of the circumstances, right? So it is very upsetting. It's a very upsetting video.
In December, the San Francisco Police Commission voted to restrict officers from seeing footage after a critical incident, like an officer-involved shooting. Police watchdogs are worried that if officers see the footage, their memory will be tainted, or they'll change their version of events. Officers are worried that without watching the footage, they'll get the story wrong.
if officers are not allowed to view what they just experienced in the incident, then, you know, they're basically writing a report blind, if you will, just by memory. And so sometimes you might leave out critical information or critical details.
And, Esparza says, that could put officers in a position of appearing dishonest when their memory fails them or their vision proves inadequate compared to the view of a body camera.
And hopefully, you know, answers lots of questions and does actually provide community with some kind of, you know, the increased in confidence in their police department.
In the meantime, the rest of us have cameras on our cell phones ready to record. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr announced last month that he plans to have all his patrol officers equipped with body cameras by the end of the year. Want to find more stories about the relationship between the public and the SFPD? Go to our website, kalw.org, click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Multimedia artist Rennie Young was born in Hong Kong and immigrated to the Bay Area at age 14. She's the creator of Chinese Whispers, a decade-long project dedicated to uncovering the hidden history of early Chinese immigrants in the American West. The project's new stage show, Golden Gate, combines the stories of 19th century Chinese immigrants with those of recent immigrants living in San Francisco's Chinatown. Young spoke with KALW's Jen Sheehan about exploring history that's hidden right under our noses and the importance of letting people speak for themselves.
Tell me about the inspiration for Chinese Whispers.
About 10 years ago, I was in Salt Lake. I was commissioned to do an artwork, an installation about the Chinese who helped build the railroads and mines in Idaho, in Sun Valley, actually. And I thought, Sun Valley, Chinese. You know, when I went there, I was one of two Chinese in Ketchum. The other person had moved from the Bay Area, and I knew him. I didn't know he had moved there. But, you know. And then I learned that almost 50% of the population of the Boise Basin in the late 19th century was Chinese. That blew me away.
And no sign of it now.
No, no. And I was part of a show with painter Hong Liu with the rather romantic name of The Vanishing, which refers specifically to this disappearance of the Chinese from the area. And through doing the research, I just became really fascinated. Until then, I had not felt particularly drawn to the history of Chinese America because it's so different from my own experience. And coming from Hong Kong, as a first-generation immigrant, I had this sense of belonging, even though the longer I stayed here, the more tenuous that belonging became.
In Hong Kong.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, just because my life was here more and more and more. And then when I did the research on the early Chinese in the West, I was both fascinated and also indignant at what happened to them.
The reasons for this vanishing. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
And right. Racist policies.
Exactly. Racist policies and also the kind of narrative that remains. That really struck me in doing all this research. I think in the last 10 years since that time, a lot of really exciting work has come out in academia about early Chinese American history. But at the time, the writings in the 19th century about the Chinese, not only were they racist or orientalizing or downright erasing chunks of history. You know, there's so many missing pieces in that history that missing, those missing links fascinated me.
As they say, history is written by the winners.
Exactly.
The dominant narrative is controlled by whoever's dominating the culture, exactly. And that wasn't Chinese Americans.
No, it was not. And then the narrative that remains about them is so parsimonious. And at the same time, what fascinated me was that people would tell me little tiny snippets of either family history or more often handed down bits of stories. It could be someone who's completely, you know, from another culture. But say, oh, yeah, I had this friend and his mom had this laundry and she told him da-da-da-da-da. And I became fascinated also by the apocryphal nature of how we understand history and how we connect to identity and roots. And so about 10 years ago, Chinese Whispers sort of was born out of this mélange of absence and fragments.
Can you explain what Chinese Whispers, the project, is? What does it consist of?
Chinese Whispers has evolved over the 10 years of its history from a storytelling project to really a suite of multi-platform projects and underlying mission to use different artistic and cultural forms to both gather stories and bring them to the public in different compelling ways. So the primary activities we do include research, storytelling events that are site-specific, because stories mean different things to people in different places.
I'm speaking with interdisciplinary artist, writer, and cultural activist Renee Young. Your piece, Chinese Whispers, Golden Gate, is a stage production. So this is another way that you use this research and information that you've gathered. And this is premiering on March 18th, but you've been working on it for a long time. We actually did a piece here on KALW about it in 2012, of a workshop version of this show. What's different about the piece now? And maybe you can talk about what it is also.
Sure. Golden Gate is a multimedia storytelling theater work. And it incorporates stories from that have been handed down over generations about the Chinese in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then we also did these storytelling workshops with immigrants from the San Francisco Chinatown YMCA.
And these are recent immigrants.
These are recent immigrants, people who at the time of the workshops had been in the States maybe 6 months, to a year, to some who had been here maybe 15, 20 years, but still self-identify as immigrants and primarily live in the San Francisco Chinatown area. And what interests me about these two groups is the both to look at what may have changed and what is the same, even though the particular flavor may have changed.
How their immigrant experiences might overlap.
Right. Issues of isolation. That does not change because it's about language, economics, and culture. For a lot of the immigrants, not being able to speak, as one of our storytellers said, he felt like when he walked out in the street, a zipper has been zipped across his mouth. You know, he just can't communicate. And the early immigrants must have really felt like that. And spatial isolation, because you can't understand what the culture is, you don't want to venture beyond your comfort zone. But also the commonality that's positive, the hope, the determination, and the resilience. These stories also come from immigrants or their descendants who have succeeded. And it's also an homage to the ones who have not succeeded, whose stories go unheard.
That was KALW's Jen Sheehan speaking with artist, designer, and writer Rennie Young. Young's organization, Chinese Whispers, presents a multimedia storytelling theater work, Golden Gate, March 18th through 20th at the Southside Theater at Fort Mason Center. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
Today, we're bringing you a sound from our Audiograph archives.
Four bells, table.
Four bells, table. Four bells, table.
Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? We sent KALW's Linda Jew to meet the folks who keep San Francisco's most iconic public transportation system in working order.
You know, when they pull in at night, they pull up past the switch over here, and we go out and we turn on all the bells and whistles because we don't want anybody driving an automobile out as the cable car comes in. And they let go of the cable, and we say, four bells, table. That means let the car go in reverse, because the conductor and the gripman, they have a set of signals. One bell means stop, two bells means go, three bells means an emergency stop. Stop right now is like somebody fell off. And four bells means reverse.
Four bells, short.
My name is Norbert Failing. I'm a supervisor in the cable car division of the San Francisco Municipal Railway. This car's just come off inspection, so it'll get new grips. It's a California streetcar, so it'll get two new grips. That way in the morning, it'll be ready to go. And the grip, which is what grabs the cable when you go up and down the hill, is kind of like a big pair of pliers. So the soft jaws of the grip are good under ideal circumstances for about 3 or 4 days. And then we pull the entire grip out, take it apart, check it for wear, lubricate it, and every day we do 3 inspections. The inspections are 15 and 60 days, and we look over everything, lubricate everything. There's a whole list of things that gets done.
Now, my biggest fear when I was growing up was going up those cable cars uphill, because I was always afraid that it would slip back. Somehow I'd lose the grip. I didn't know how it worked when I was growing up, and I was always afraid of being in a cable car that would ran away down the hill.
Doesn't happen very often. Doesn't happen very often, and going uphill hardly happens at all. Even if you lose the cable, they have, well, the car has 3 sets of brakes. Each car has 3 sets of brakes. The main brake is the track brake, which consists of 4 pieces of 2-foot-long straight grain fur that are clamped between the wheels. And when you pull back the big handle on the right of the gripman's position, that pushes those pieces of wood down against the track. That's the main service brake of a cable car. And when you're going down a steep hill with a full load, you can get a nice campfire smell off of those, because they will get so hot that they just about start, they don't really burn, but they get nice and hot and you can smell them. The people in the 19th century really worked this out well. And while we have occasionally found something we could improve, for the most part, the engineering they did was brilliant. And because the engineers in that time thought in purely mechanical terms, they had an advantage over the engineers of our day, who tend to try and figure out an electronic solution to a problem. And these cars, they don't really need any of that.
It's amazing.
It really is.
KALW's Linda Jew knew a lot about the cable car barn. That's because her dad worked there, and she grew up just around the corner, listening to the sounds of the cars out her bedroom window. Ready for another iconic San Francisco sound? Here's your sneak listen.
Where is the Golden Bridge from here? Can I have your binocular a little bit for your time?
Oh, I see. Oh, it's a little.
When you get up to the top, you have a 360-degree view.
I got it. I zoomed in. It's perfect.
Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? Give us a call and tell us, 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. And for all you Cross Currents fans out there, subscribe to our podcast. You can hear Cross Currents when you want and catch up on past episodes. You can even search our shows by subject. Find out how at kalw.org/subscribe. Our team includes Shireen Adil, Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
Well, darling, I thought that you knew.
This music is by the Blondies. They're playing at the Freight and Salvage in Berkeley on Saturday as part of a program called The Freight Goes British, where student musicians perform music from the British invasion of the 1960s. Music starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Only with you.